Hello, welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 21 for October 20th, 2009. I'm your host, Dominic Rabia, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you today, one covering an antitrust inquiry into IBM for mainframes, another covering Microsoft's appellate or Microsoft's amicus brief for the Bilski case that will soon be before the Supreme Court in early November, and finally a third story covering the GPL and whether it's legally viable. Let's dive in right into our first story with antitrust, IBM, and mainframes. It's 1969 all over again, apparently, because this is the last time the Department of Justice investigated IBM for antitrust activity in connection to its mainframe business, and apparently it's investigating it again because IBM has significant market share and significant market power in the mainframe business. And let's start off with the distinction between what is the difference between market share and market power?
Well, market share is just the percentage. Let's say every year they sold 100 units in the entire market. Let's say the market's for mainframes in this case. Market share is how much of that percentage you own. It's, you know, whether or not it's 90% or 20%. Market power, however, is a totally different term. And that relates to whether or not you have the ability to control prices in the market. And that doesn't necessarily go with market share. It doesn't even necessarily go with a monopoly. So market power and monopoly power are not necessarily commensurate. Like, you could have a patent on something, but not also have the power to command what the price is for that good.
So in this story, IBM is being investigated by the Department of Justice for basically monopoly or antitrust violations. This sort of was precipitated by a small company called T3 Technologies that sued IBM for basically the same sort of thing, and this sort of brought to the Justice Department's attention, and they started investigating IBM. The biggest about this story is that IBM doesn't license the software that it sells with its mainframes, which means that people want to build clone mainframes, they can't, because they can't get the software that is at the core of these mainframes. Should IBM be forced to license its software out?
Well, first of all, just to back up a little bit, the story's a little bit more complicated because there's two separate inquiries that went on, so to speak. So T3 is this company that was actually the sole distributor of another company called Platform Solutions. Just a few years back, Platform Solutions came up with this new innovative solution that in the mainframe industry. And IBM didn't really like it that much because they found it a little bit too competitive with their products. So IBM went after this company, Platform Solutions, and the litigation didn't end up going anywhere. For whatever reason, the claims weren't viable in court. And so IBM's solution was to buy Platform Solutions, and they purchased them approximately $150 million. Now, T3, as the sole distributor of the Platform Solutions, was a little upset because IBM decided they were going to terminate the Platform Solutions product altogether. And that's where T3 came in, and they've proceeded against IBM in court. Now, I don't think that litigation went anywhere either. And this is where this trade group called Computer Communications, the Computer Communications Industry Association, or the CCIA, has filed their complaint. And that trade group represents a variety of the main tech giants, I think, included in there, Microsoft's included in there, and some others. And so they've actually filed a complaint.
Oh, it's Google, Microsoft, Oracle, Yahoo, AMD, Sun, a lot of the big players in the industry, but notably not IBM and, I guess, Apple.
Right. Mm. So they represent a large number of the companies, and this is what has prompted, I believe, the Department of Justice inquiry into IBM's practices. And sort of the core component is that IBM is engaging in restraints of trade or some other type of anti-competitive behavior, in that they're foreclosing the market competition by either, at least in the Platform Solutions scenario, by buying out some competitors and then completely mm-hmm. terminating the products.
So can IBM basically do that if it sees a competitor it doesn't like and is able to buy it out and then just discontinue the product line and continue business as usual? Because that seems to be what they did with Platform Solutions, right? Like, is there anything in antitrust law that says, well, you can't really buy out your competitors and discontinue their product to remove competition from the market?
Well, there's a variety of different statutes out there which govern this area, and certainly some combinations that can be in restraint of trade, meaning mergers and acquisitions. In this case, it was an acquisition. It sort of depends on how you characterize a particular acquisition, but if you have some certain scenarios within the marketplace, and if you have, say, if IBM is definitely has a monopoly in this particular area, and they are effectuating these acquisitions to continue their monopoly power and also continue to have the ability to affect price, that's something that will fall under, I believe, the Sherman Act. And I want to say Sherman Act Section 2 and possibly Section 7 would govern this.
But there's nothing in, up on that. There's nothing in antitrust law that says this and this action. It's not so black and white. In other words, it's all subject to interpretation of the actual law in terms of what constitutes restraint of trade.
Very much so. And just the act – well, first of all, IBM also has, I believe, a software patent on – some of their software solutions that are implemented on their mainframe systems. Just because they have a soft patent on that and they're not willing to license that out, that act by itself is not enough for an antitrust violation. What is enough, though, what is potentially enough, is that if IBM engages in certain types of activity, either create monopoly power to maintain its monopoly power, that's getting into the gray areas where you have to have some sort of judicial review, but those are potential antitrust violations.
The antitrust statutes are all subject to interpretation, ideally by a judge, but initially by the Department of Justice, which gets to decide whether it wants to bring an action. Right now, the DOJ has not decided to bring a formal action against IBM. They're simply investigating, contacting the computer IBM in the mainframe market, and inquiries to see what's going on in this market.
An interesting thing about this is while the T3's lawsuit that was dismissed, while that was dismissed because it didn't have a meritorious claim, the government can still pursue this for two reasons. One, because the government comes at it from a different angle. And secondly, they have subpoena power that T3, where T3 was more limited, the government can go to IBM and T3 and say, just give us all of your records relating to this, and they pretty much have to. So while T3 may not have been able to find, you know, a smoking gun, the Department of Justice has significantly broader ability to go in and, you know, find that smoking gun even early in litigation.
David Liu, any thoughts?
Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, it's the first time that IBM has had trouble with the antitrust suits from the government. And so I'm sort of curious what your guys' take is, why this is different than the first time.
I guess what happened the first time was it was 1969, and the Department of Justice started investigating IBM and actually pursued a suit until the Reagan administration came by in 1980, dropped the case after 13 years. I'm not really familiar with all the details, but that's sort of the very, very high picture of what happened. And the suit didn't go anywhere. IBM wasn't broken up or anything. At the time, the mainframe market was a big deal in the very late 60s and became far less of a big deal by the time the early 80s rolled around. The biggest surprising thing to me in this story is how big the mainframe still is. Mainframes aren't something that I really think of every day. But they're still a big part of many companies, and it looks like it's about $25 billion in revenue for IBM a year, which is an astronomical figure if you think about it.
You got to wonder how many machines that is, though.
Yeah. Mainframes are pretty much everywhere. Like ATMs power basically are dumb clients to mainframes. A lot of the health industry set stuff up in the early 70s and 80s and are still using legacy systems that need to be maintained. So it's not surprising that competitors are trying to get into this marketplace, and it's not surprising that they're turning to antitrust tools to try to help break into the marketplace, because if they don't feel that they're getting a fair shot at the market, they're going to go to the Department of Justice and say, hey, you guys should investigate this. We tried suing them. Our case got tossed out because we don't have the standing, or our claim wasn't meritorious. And as Ben said, the DOJ has superior subpoena power, and they can go in and take a closer look at IBM's business activities.
Right. So one of the frustrating things, too, is that to some extent you want a lot of competitors in a particular marketplace because it can fuel innovation. The things that a natural monopoly holder like IBM might be, the things that they sometimes don't think about is how to continuously innovate their products because there's no other competitors in the marketplace that are sort of forcing them to come up with new and interesting ways to do things. These smaller companies, though, that are trying to break in as early market entrants, they are thinking that way, though, because they're thinking about how they could sort of knock IBM out of its position. And if the marketplace is going to continue to be sort of foreclosed by IBM, either by way of acquisition or by way of patent licensing, it just frustrates that purpose entirely. And so it's no wonder to me that the DOJ is potentially still interested in this.
Makes perfect sense. Ben, David Liu, any other thoughts?
I'm good. David?
Other than their market share and the one action of buying out the competitor, is there anything else that's making IBM seem monopolistic?
I guess the fact that they don't want to license their software doesn't make them seem monopolistic. Certainly, I guess it sets up sort of market conditions where they start to have, it's their market power basically in that they can start setting the price, and since there are no competitors because they can't license their software or their competitors have to homebrew their software, it becomes they're able to set whatever price they like, allegedly. Ben or David or Brian?
I mean, we don't have a lot of information to go on, but I agree with your characterization that there's not a whole lot here that's leaning toward finding them that they've been monopolistic, but a lot of that's because there's just been so little activity in the field recently. I mean, IBM has a lock on most of the mainframe production, and it seems like from the article, all of the software, to the extent that these people who want to compete are trying to make IBM software compatible computers. So, you know, it with so little data, it's hard to pin, you know, every single monopolistic act or possibly monopolistic act down.
And again, this isn't a lawsuit. This is just an investigation. The Department of Justice may decide that it doesn't find anything. But basically, there's enough here that it makes them want to take a closer look. So, David or Brian, any other thoughts?
No, I think you guys have covered this pretty thoroughly. But, you know, as I think we've all said, and not to beat a dead horse here, it's been characterized as a company that is unwilling to work with some of the new innovators. And it seems that a lot of their business actions seem to resonate the fact that they're just unwilling to either continuously innovate or to at least help out the little guy a little bit, even for you know, some sort of monetary transaction.
At least in the market for mainframes, IBM is pretty open to the open source community innovation in other markets, and it is a very big company, which is worth keeping in mind. All right. I guess we'll move on to our next story. The next story concerns the Bilski case, which is the patent case that will be coming before the Supreme Court in very early November. I think the first hearings are November 9th. And amicus briefs, which are friend of the court briefs, that basically that means that third parties can write in and say, hey, we've got an opinion on this case. You guys should read our opinion because we think it'll help you decide the case. And since this Bilski case is so important to software patents and patent method patents in general, lots and lots of people have filed amicus briefs. Among them, Microsoft with Symantec and Philips have filed a brief with a particularly, I don't want to say unique, but a particularly interesting way of arguing what software is. And the reason method patents and software patents seem to, and this is sort of a summary of what the brief argues, if we go back to the elder days of computers, all the way back to Charles Babbage's adding machine that he never actually built, there you had a mechanical system that would make a series of processes, and they would do these, would make calculations based on these processes. And software basically is an electronization of such a mechanical system as it becomes more and more complex and goes faster and faster and gets run by a processor. But one part argue that software does nothing that a human wouldn't be able to do themselves. It just does stuff much, much, much faster. But another side of the argument is that, no, there's something fundamentally different, the fact that software is going with such an order of magnitude, many order of magnitudes faster than what humans can do. I guess Microsoft's argument in this brief is that the software's role is to, quote, simply automate the reconfiguration of the electronic pathways that was once done manually by the human operators of ENIAC, which was a very early mainframe computer in the late 40s. So they're saying that computer-implemented processes are eligible any other patent-eligible process in that there's physical activity with human-directed logic. And find physical activity down to a very low level, including changes in basically electric charge and changing the electric levels and the circuitry. Basically, transistors are on-off switches, and since modern chips have millions, if not billions, of such transistors, the process for manipulating these in terms of software from something such as, say, Microsoft Windows is patentable, according to Microsoft. Guys, do you have any thoughts on this, or take a step back, a different picture?
Yeah, I think we have to take a step back and briefly go over again why it's an issue whether or not software is patentable. So one of the principles of patent law is that you can't patent, I shouldn't have used the word principle in this sentence once already, you can't patent a principle. You can't patent E equals MC squared because that's something that's inherent in nature. You didn't invent it, you just discovered it.
Abstract ideas are laws of nature is what you're looking for.
Yeah, abstract ideas and laws of nature. And part of the problem is that apparently, and David Liu may be able to chime in on this, there's some sort of proof that you can do that every computer program is essentially just a series of mathematical equations. Like every computer program can be broken down into a math equation. And if a math equation isn't patentable, how can software be patentable? And Microsoft's argument, as Dominic was saying, is essentially that it's patentable because the software program makes physical changes, and those physical changes are, you know, routing of electrons in a certain way. And I have difficulty with that argument.
Yeah, it's not quite breaking it down to a mathematical equation level, but a mathematical process. If this is true, then do this. And on some level, it's you can reduce most programs down to a very basic level like that, with some levels of abstraction. But
at the same time, you can't. I mean, doing mathematical proofs of programs for correctness is very difficult. Only trivial programs really can be mathematically proved correct. Even somewhat complex programs would be very difficult to prove, and something as complex as Microsoft Windows would be practically impossible to prove correct. And proof of correctness is basically sort of what you would need for it to really be a mathematical proof in terms of a mathematical concept. I guess the reason I like this argument is because I think that it is analogous. If you go back to look at history and say, well, this is just how software has evolved in that originally these adding machines, and now we have a circuit which does the same thing. A human sets up the process and then it runs through the electronics, and you should be able to patent the process. The process in this case is a set of instructions for a chip to execute, but that process is still patentable, and it's distinct from a mathematical sequence in that it isn't something that's to a simple mathematical principle or in so.
I mean,
well,
but
I think one of the what this sort of boils down to a little bit is that what we're talking about is abstract principles and potentially the application of abstract principles. And from what it sounds like, Dominic is more on this, that the application of these abstract principles, even though in some circumstances computer software can be broken down as just an abstract principle, the application of those abstract principles into software in the form of source code and then the compiled object code and the way that it runs onto a machine, that in itself is enough transformation of that principle to make it into a patentable process. Whereas you guys seem to take the view that it's just an abstract principle, and therefore it should not be patented.
So I'm going to amend what I said previously a little bit in that I don't think that I haven't gone through this enough to be positive, but I imagine there are some software that would be patentable. The problem that I have with Microsoft's argument is that their argument is that every software program, no matter how simple, I mean, as long as it meets the other patentability requirements, is patentable.
Well, they argue, actually, that the machine or transformation, like, I guess, the Bilski patent, which is the one actually at issue here, and which is may limit what the Supreme Court can act, but may not, depending on how inventive the Supreme Court wants to be. The Bilski patent was rejected by the lower court based on a machine or transformation test, saying that it has to involve a machine or transformation test. And does anyone want to quickly summarize what the Bilski patent is about?
It's about hedging risk, essentially. I don't remember the details, but it's
commodity trading.
Yeah.
So it's that's basically correct, that it's hedging risk, commodity trading, and it doesn't actually involve any computers necessarily or software at all in the patent. It's just a process, a method, do this to hedge risk. And the lower court rejected it because it applied the machine or transformation test, saying, hey, there's no machine involved here, because there wasn't, and there's no transformation of something in the real world. All that happens is you move money around in bank accounts. There's nothing physically tangible that's moving around. Tangible is another magic word in some ways, but I don't mean it in the magic word sense, term of art sense, I guess. So there's nothing that is transformed here. Microsoft, in their amicus brief, says, we agree with the lower court's rejection, but we don't agree with the standard they use. We don't like the machine or transformation test because of the way it interacts with software, because software itself isn't tied to a particular machine, because software is run on a general purpose computer. And ever since the Bilski decision came out, the patent office has been accepting patent applications because they said, well, this is only for general computer, not tied to a particular machine. Therefore, we're going to reject it under the machine or transformation test because you need tied to a particular machine. Since a general purpose computer is a particular machine, we're going to reject your patent and we're not going to grant your software patent. They haven't been consistently, as far as I know, but they have been doing it, which is why the Bilski decision is important to software patents.
I'd just like to point out that Microsoft was making the same argument that I made the last time we talked about Bilski. I don't remember what conclusion I came to, but I came to the conclusion, at least one conclusion, that the Supreme Court's going to reverse, at least on the test, if not on the decision, that, you know, they're going to say that the machine learning transformation test is too narrow and that the Federal Circuit needs to stop construing their test so narrowly.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that prognosis. Microsoft, it's a different standard. They suggest a new standard, which to me seems somewhat redundant, considering new novelty is already one of the grounds of patentability, right?
Yes,
right.
It is. I don't think they were suggesting a new test. I thought they were just suggesting that you abide by the old test. But I'm going to go back to my previous point, which is that under their argument that as long as it meets the other requirements of patentability, any software program is patentable, and it seems to do that to the exclusion of the principle that laws of nature rule, because I could think of a program that, you know, just applied a law of nature, but Microsoft would still hold that it was patentable because it made that physical transformation, that physical change inside the chips of routing the electrons in a different way.
Can you give us such an example of a program?
Let's say I invented a program, and there's one that already exists like this, but what it does is the program can calculate the gravitational pull of many stellar bodies and simulate them on the computer. That's just applying Newton's laws of physics, gravity. But assuming it's novel and assuming it's useful, it would be patentable, according to Microsoft.
Mm.
Well, I think that Microsoft said that this what they're suggesting is that these would only be potentially eligible for patentability, not necessarily that they're patentable, just on the face of meeting all those requirements. I think it what they were suggesting, it still leaves some deference, at least, to the patent office to reject the standards that already exist.
So you think that program wouldn't necessarily be patentable because it's just applying laws of nature?
I can't have to have the expertise that would be required of a patent examiner in the U.S. Patent Office, but you know, I think it depends a lot on the actual circumstances.
One of the main arguments against software patents is basically, and to put it in a real simple form, which probably simplifies it a bit, is that software is math, and math shouldn't be patentable. Would that be an accurate summary, do you think, Ben?
Well, I would say that math isn't patentable, but yes.
Is not.
Yeah, you said shouldn't be, and I'm going to correct you to say math is not patentable. But yeah.
Math is not patentable. Software is math. Ergo, software should not be patentable because it's math, and math is not patentable.
Right.
Oh, but wait. So let's say that we were the Supreme Court here, us, our little four-person panel, and let's say we completely reject the patentability at all in a decision of software. What then are we leaving to innovators in terms of IP protection?
I was going to bring this up anyway, but you still have copyright, which only protects the actual code that you use. But I think it's time for the U.S. Congress to create some sort of other copyright. I'm sorry, some sort of other protection, similar to what they did for trademarks, which is under the Commerce Clause, to protect software like this. Because what you really need for software isn't the robust and long-term protection of patents. What you need is something that's much shorter. You need something that lasts maybe 10 years or, you know, five or 10 years at most. Because software that was patented 20 years ago is entirely obsolete now. And it just hurts the market to have these exceptionally long patents on software. And not a very good way to do it.
This is my fundamental problem with the arguments of people that say that software is not patentable. It's just that we could get ourselves lost here and we could talk about for hours the nuances of the statutory language and the case law as it exists today and how it's applied to software patents. But the reality is that I think that the developers of software need to have some sort of form of intellectual property that protects their inventions. And the truth of the matter is that copyright, although it does apply to software, it really only applies to the expression, as you said, Ben. That only really protects the source code. But there are 100 different ways that you could implement code, and you could completely rewrite source code so that it does not appear to be an actual copy of another person's source code, but still accomplishes the same functionality. And I think that's just where copyright falls short, and that's why you need something that's a little bit more robust like patent.
Let's posit a hypothetical. David Liu comes up with some amazing new software idea. He codes it up, and he says, I've written my code, and I want to protect it. What options does he have? He could try to distill down the solution that he's embodied in his program and apply for a patent. He could try to copyright his code, but that would not do anything about his competitors just cloning it while writing different code. Does he have any other options?
Trade secret. He could not do anything and keep the code completely confidential and locked up.
But if he wants to make money off of it and he's selling it compiled, it can always be reverse engineered.
So you have something in your terms of service agreement, your EULA, that says you can't reverse engineer or decompile the code, which have shown to be have a dubious enforceability, but it's still a...
Oh, no, actually, I wouldn't say that that's dubious. Actually, the reverse engineering clauses in EULAs have been constantly upheld. That's one of the weird things that that you can contract away your fair use rights to be able to reverse engineer something. So far.
So would that be adequate protection without getting a patent? I mean, let's posit that software patents are stricken down. What happens to the world?
Well, I don't know. I just think that using the EULAs is a little bit imperfect because you still have to enforce your rights in the actual EULA. And I guess once somebody already reverse engineers your code and it gets distributed out, you're talking about suing multiple entities and it's been distributed across the internet. Not that necessarily protects that any better, but I think that you could use it as a little bit more of a strong arm weapon rather than a contractual right that you're enforcing in a state court or something.
Yeah, the biggest problem with the EULA is that you need privity between the parties to enforce it. You need somebody else to click the accept on the end user license agreement for it to be enforceable against them.
Right, and there's always the get your 12-year-old cousin to click the agreement for you to circumvent it yourself.
Well, I suppose that is somewhat of a dubious argument itself, but you're right. I think that there are there's problems, and it also assumes that the EULA itself is enforceable, and you can always have a scenario where you think you've written a tight license and you screw something up in it, and for whatever reason, totally invalidates that license. That has not actually happened a whole lot, if at all. But it's a one of those risks that you take if you don't have the affirmative right under statutory law to restrict something in a particular way.
All right. We'll likely be covering Bilski in much more detail, especially once the court starts hearing arguments, which I believe starts November 9th. So look for more on Bilski next month. We'll move on now to our third and final story. Effectively, this one's about the GPL, the GNU Public License version 2, which was the previous version, because now GPL 3 is out. And basically, two IP lawyers have written an article warning and actually made a presentation, I believe, that warning that the version 2 of the GPL is legally ambiguous, and this could have legal ramifications for GPL 2 licensees. Their reasoning behind this claim of legal ambiguity is that basically the GPL license itself, version 2 that is or the derivative work and distribution in a somewhat less precise fashion, which leads to ambiguity in that a derivative work has a very specific meaning in copyright law with regards to stuff that was envisioned when they wrote the copyright law to use the word derivative work, like a book or even a movie. But in terms of software, it's unclear exactly what constitutes a derivative work. For example, say I write a linked library and I say, here, I'm licensing this under the GPL 2. You can hard link this into your code. Does the new hard linked executable, which contains my library being accessed by someone else's code, does that constitute a derivative work? I mean, or is that just my library hard linked in? And that is a fuzzy question still, as far as I know. Any thoughts on this story or anything else that you guys want to talk about?
Well, the GPL2 does say that the quote program below refers to any such program or work, and quote work based on the program means either the program, any derivative work under copyright law, colon, that is to say, a work containing the program or a portion of it, either verbatim or with modifications, and or translated into another language. Now, that's not perfectly clear language, mm-hmm. but it seems to say that, you know, when we're talking about derivative works, we mean stuff that contains the program. I don't find this ambiguity as troublesome as the lawyers who wrote that question are.
I think that the concern here is what the GPL seeks to accomplish, and that's basically if you're using large portions of any GPL licensed software, you have to include, if you're going to release, say, the precompiled binaries, you also have to include the source code for that software. So there's so much out there now that is licensed under the GPL, and that, as you mentioned, Dominic, it has now three different iterations of it. So potentially there's a large portion that has been licensed under this version too. There's so much code out there, and the way that the license is worded, it seems that if you use anything that would possibly fall under the GPL in your own code, it'll open up all of your code. And so some of the tech companies that use portions of the GPL are concerned that, well, if we're just going to use a small portion of GPL licensed code, or something maybe that just approximates it. Let's say that we don't use it verbatim. We write our own version of it that's just a little bit different. That version is close enough, especially if we've consulted the GPL licensed code, that under those license terms, we'll have to open up the source code to all of our software.
Makes sense. David Liu, any thoughts on this from the academic side of things?
I suppose I just have a more fundamental question is, in what I mean, so I write this great program that, and what sort of general protections are afforded to me under these different licenses? I guess that's a distinction that has escaped me for a couple of years now.
What general protections are afforded you under
the versions of the GPLs?
Yeah.
Well, they vary a little bit. The notable changes in version 3, I believe, as compared to version 2, are that they've gone forward and actually defined these two different terms which are used in version 2. As Ben noted, that derivative works and distribution are more tightly defined as adaptive works that are based upon a previous work that's licensed under the GPL v3. What you're basically getting, though, is as the copyright owner, the person who's actually authored the code, you're going to have the ability to enforce those license rights against anybody who uses any version of your GPL code in the future. And you also have the other terms, as I mentioned before, is that it requires all people to basically open up their code, including the source code. So if people aren't complying with those terms, as the author, you have the ability to go after them in a court of law.
Makes sense.
Right. An interesting side note, just to jump in there for a second, David, is that in some earlier litigation, there's been actually, I don't think this has been litigated under the GPL. It's been litigated under other licenses. There's a question as to whether or not you can only go after people for contract damages or also copyright infringement. My understanding is that the GPL version 3 leans more toward contract remedies for breach of contract rather than copyright infringement. Is that right?
That's a good question.
I believe so. My understanding is that GPL v2 sort of tried piggybacking on copyright law and trying to use it as a contractual weapon, whereas GPL 3 sort of went and said, all right, let's this into more contract law so that we can perhaps avoid using copyright that way.
Now, Dave? Going back to what you were talking about before, Ben, the interpretation of these words, I do kind of think it is a little bit more clear than these two attorneys made it out to be, and I think that those terms, derivative works and distribution, were intended to be as broadly interpreted as possible under the Copyright Act, and maybe it's just the case that people are afraid that these things are so broad that they encompass just about everything as compared to the latter version of the GPL. I don't know that there's so much problem there that it creates some sort of scenario where the GPL v2 might be invalidated under that, though. You do get these problems, though, with contractual ambiguity. If you have ambiguity in a contract, then you have a scenario where someone could seek to put in, let's say, if there was a litigation going on, parole evidence of what those terms actually mean. Parole evidence just means extrinsic evidence outside of the four corners of the contract to try to interpret the meaning of those terms. And I suppose that, that could lead to some sort of dire consequences for the litigants. Aside from that, though, I suppose you could also have scenarios where a contract is so vaguely or ambiguously worded, you could have a court say that there's not actually a contract here at all because it's just not clear what these things mean. But again, I do kind of think that these are sort of well-understood terms, at least under copyright law, and probably well-understood enough to be – or extremely broad, excuse me, not extremely ambiguous.
Yeah, I think a court would be very reluctant to find that there was no contract here because these terms were so ambiguous. But, the GPL is one of these things that, despite having been around for a very long time, has largely evaded any type of litigation in the United States.
It'll be an interesting question to see whether it continues to avoid litigation. Although I don't know of anyone planning to litigate. Any other thoughts or ideas about this story?
I've gotten everything that I want to say out. You guys?
Nope, not in particular.
I'm set.
All right, we can end this podcast early unless people want to talk about anything else. Then, we'll end the podcast there. Thanks all for listening, and podcast 21. I'm your host, Dominic Rabia, and with me today were
Ben Snitkoff,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful week.
To this, I have to say, David O'Brien, sucker!
Sucker.
O'Brien's editing the podcast this week. That's why I'm mocking him.
Okay. Yeah.